From Birmingham, Alabama, this is Art Stories Radio. The stories you're about to hear are true, personal, and told by the people who live them in front of a live audience at one of our Art Stories events.
My father seemed to really respect the pastor of the church, and I was trying to get my father's approval, and so I dedicated my life to the ministry. Before that, my father would introduce me, that's my only boy, we're trying to keep him from being a spoiled brat.
I'm Taylor Robinson, and today we have four stories about people faced with tense, awkward situations of their own making.
And I walked into the executive director's office and I said to him, I am going to need some place to go every day, and it cannot be that newspaper office ever again.
We created Arc Stories to give Birmingham a place to tell its stories to the world. So coming up after the news, Birmingham's own true stories. Welcome to Arc Stories Radio. I'm Taylor Robinson, Arc Stories Director, and I'm joined by my co-host and story coach, Chris Kinsley.
Today we have four stories, each recorded throughout Birmingham and each with a different theme. They include a story of a man fearing for his life, one about a young girl impersonating someone of a different race and gender, and another about a father trying to keep up appearances in front of his daughter.
Every story worth its merit has some sort of conflict, and the hero of every story is the one who faces and overcomes that conflict. The greater the conflict, the greater the hero. So what does it look like when the conflict is between the hero and an entire society? That's the case in our first story. And as a warning, there is a particular racial slur used in this story. It was from an event we hosted in partnership with the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, where the theme was Marching On, Stories About Growing Up in the Civil Rights Era. Here's storyteller Robert Powell.
I was born in 1940 in the old TCI hospital. TCI stood at that time for Tennessee Coal Iron Railroad Company, which had bought out the Bart Laban Coal Company, and which was in turn taken over by U.S. Steel years later. My dad was a steel worker. My mother was a homemaker. I was an only child and got my folks into church. When I was born, without even knowing it, the next-door neighbor wanted to take me to the cradle roll at Hunter Street Baptist Church, and what kind of parents would let the neighbor take the kid to church and not go themselves? So they kind of got back in church, and that sort of set me on the path of being the savior, the messianic figure in the family. When I was about seven, I dedicated my life to the ministry. In the Baptist church, you can do that. You might imagine what a seven-year-old knows about being a pastor. Doesn't know squat. What I did know was that my father seemed to really respect the pastor of the church, and I was trying to get my father's approval, and so I dedicated my life to the ministry. Before that, my father would introduce me, that's my only boy, we're trying to keep him from being a spoiled brat. After that, he would introduce me, that's my only boy, he's going to make a preacher. So I got a little status in the family out of that. Went through Howard College here, Samford University now, as a ministerial student, and then went to New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary in the Crescent City, down on the banks of the Mississippi. And during that time, I majored in Christian ethics. And in one of the courses, social issues and the pastor, we had to write a paper. And I looked over the various areas and decided I would write a paper on race relations. And I titled it, Can a Christian Be a Racist? Some other seminarians, a little more academically inclined than I was, they wanted to start a seminary theological paper or journal to publish articles. And one of them asked me if he could take my paper and publish it in the seminary journal. Well, sure, that's fine with me. And he did. And it came out in a couple weeks with my paper headline, Can a Christian Be a Racist? Right there on the front page. And I don't know what I expected, but what I did not expect was a ruckus. And that's what we got. I had several seminary students, fellow students, want to punch me out. They did not agree with my conclusion that a Christian cannot be a racist. They were segregationist. Now, forever, as George Wallace famously said back along the way. And we went on. I finished, went into the graduate program, doctoral studies, and at the same time was called to my first parish, which was up in Pike County, Mississippi, 100 miles from the campus, Mount Zion Baptist Church. We were out from Progress Community, which was out from Osaka, which was out from Magnolia, which was out from Macomb, Mississippi. Macomb's a county seat. We were out. The old saying, lightning had to change gears twice to get back there where we were, out in the country. And we were there about 3 weeks, and then the next Saturday, I was visiting in the community in the dairy barn of one of my parishioners, Brother Thad and Miss Betty Simmons. We were talking, investing, and a green Ford Falcon station wagon pulled up in the barnyard. We had six deacons in the congregation. In the Baptist church, the deacons function sort of as the leaders in the congregation, sometimes like a board of directors, sometimes like executioners or inquisitors, oftentimes very helpful for the pastor and the congregation. We had six of them. The youngest one was in the station wagon that pulled up in the barnyard, came in where I was visiting with Ed and Betty. "Hello, Ed, Edwin Connerly. How you doing?" "Fine, preacher, can I see you a minute?" "Sure." I walked out with him, walked up to his wagon, windows were open, it was a warm day, and pointed down the front seat, said, "Preacher, did you write that?" And I looked down there, and it was a copy of that seminary journal, "Can a Christian Be a Racist?" by Bob Powell. "Yes, Ed, I did." You've heard the saying, your whole life flashed before your eyes. Several lifetimes flashed before my eyes. This was 1964, Pike County, Mississippi. Less than 6 months prior to this time, some racist murderers had buried three civil rights workers named Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman under a dam, killed them, buried them under a dam in Philadelphia, Mississippi, about 60 miles away. This was a tense time, a difficult time. Edwin said, "Preacher, we got to do something about this." I said, "All right, we'll talk it over in the deacons next Saturday night." So we did services on Sunday, just like usual. Went back to seminary, in class during the week, writing papers, thinking every day, to some degree, about what in the world was going to happen the next Saturday up at the church. And after that, what was going to happen? Didn't know. We came up on Saturday. I visited around during the day. And then about 7 o'clock, I sat down in the front room of that rural Mississippi parsonage. And I tried to explain to six rural white Mississippi laymen what I had said in that paper. You may wonder, how did Edwin Connerly come up with that paper? One of my seminary colleagues, who was pastor of a little church in Louisiana, had Edwin Connerly's brother-in-law as a member of that congregation. My colleague had taken a copy of that paper up to his church, given it to his deacon, told him to give it to my deacon, and make the most of it in the community. In case you missed it, this is a professional assassination attempt on that part. No physical danger, but professionally, he was trying to do me in. So we talked that night, those guys and I, and two things I think made it work, kept us there. Number one was my carefully defining racist as someone who actively promotes hatred between racial groups. Well, they felt better as soon as they heard that. "We don't hate our niggers, preacher." They can sit on the back porch and eat out there when they come work around the house. That doesn't apply to us. You weren't talking about us in that situation. They felt better. They did not realize the hierarchical, discriminatory nature of the relationship that they had. The second thing, and probably more significant, was that the good old Baptist iconoclasm, another church, was meddling in our church's business, trying to tell us what to do. Baptists don't like that. And so they told Edwin to send the paper back to his brother-in-law and tell him to keep his nose out of our church's business. In effect, they affirmed Lane and me, who we were, our ministry, gave us a vote of confidence. Now, this was in the middle of the church, but this never came before the congregation, formally. I'm sure these guys talked to their spouses and talked to their kids, and the word got out in the community and in the congregation about it, but there was no formal action taken on the part of the congregation. We survived for the next several weeks. Every time a car went by at night, I kind of froze up a little bit, didn't know what was going to happen. A couple of corollaries, 1 week after this, car pulled up on Saturday afternoon. I walked out, see who it was, and a young man got out, introduced himself. I introduced myself. I said, can I help you? What can we do for you? He said, well, I understand they're going to be needing a preacher around here. I said, unless you know something I don't, that's a mistake, a notion. I'm the pastor here, duly called and installed. And, well, I just heard they were going to need a preacher around here. And he said it about three times. And about the third time he said it, it occurred to me, oops, this has something to do with that other situation. He got back in the car and left. The only other corollary, got to fast forward about 10 months to the next summer. I was preaching through the book of Galatians in the New Testament and ran into this text and said, oops, but here it is, Galatians 3, 27 and 28. Says, you were all baptized into Christ. You're a new creature. There's no longer Jew nor Greek. There's no longer male nor female. There's no longer slave or free. For you're all one in Christ Jesus. And in that sermon, I made the point, one of the difficulties that we have in the South is the difficulty in getting away from the slave and the free mentality. One of the hardest things to deal with, most insidious and most difficult for the white people in the South, is the discriminatory attitude toward African-American citizens. Finished the sermon, had the benediction, went back to the back to glad hand everybody out. One of the deacons came up to me and said, preacher, some of them folks not gonna like that. And it occurred to me, maybe some of them will. That's about all the preacher can help for. Who hath ears to hear, let them hear.
Dr. Robert Powell has served in a number of roles in Christian ministry. He is currently involved in a variety of settings around Birmingham, in pastoral counseling, clinical pastoral education, and parish ministry.
Dr. Powell's story is so much fun to listen to, and he is so charming that you almost forget how serious of a situation he actually found himself in. I mean, nothing came of it, obviously, but it wouldn't have been unheard of for those threats of professional assassination to actually turn into something much more serious. And few of us know what that's really like.
Yeah, that's true. But most of us do know what it's like to feel betrayed. And to me, that is what is most tragic about his story. It's his supposed Christian brothers that were doing their best to take him down, all because he was just trying to do the right thing.
I kind of think that makes the threats feel even more ominous.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how was he supposed to know who he could trust? In fact, the storyteller in our next story is faced with that same question when he feels like he might be threatened himself. That's coming up in just a moment on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories. This is ARC Stories Radio. We're bringing you true personal stories told live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham by the people who live them. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley with ARC Stories director Taylor Robinson.
I mentioned earlier how essential conflict is to the basic structure of any story. However, conflict doesn't always come from outside sources. In fact, sometimes that conflict arises from within us and can even be of our own making. And that is certainly the case in this next story. It's from an event we hosted a few years ago at Second Row Studios here in Birmingham. The theme for the night was True Stories from the Journey. Here's storyteller Josh Pickford.
All right, so about 12 years ago, I was 17, working my first job at a family Christian bookstore, which is really awesome in hindsight. I'd been working there, I don't know, a year or so, and it was a typical, like, sales kind of job. I mean, like, I'm selling, like, Bibles and VeggieTales and, like, VeggieTale-themed Bibles. And, and so I go in one night, I think it was, like, a Saturday night. I probably went in for a night shift. Went in after lunch sometime. So I was there 5 hours or so, and Robert, our manager, comes in, or he's actually about to leave, and he says, I gotta tell you guys, so there's me and Lance. So Lance is, he's my coworker, and he's worked at Family Christian for probably 10 years, just being a sales guy, like not moving up. He's a career Family Christian man. And, so Lance is there, I'm there, and Robert, he's walking out and he says, oh, by the way, guys, don't freak out, but last night, the Piccadilly next door was robbed at gunpoint. Who robs a Piccadilly, right? But, So he's like, but don't worry, like, they didn't catch him, but don't worry. Like, it's not a big deal, like, but just, like, kind of be on the lookout, like, use caution, you know? And I'm like, all right, like, I'm 17, like, I'm awesome, and I can take anybody who's trying to rob a Christian bookstore. What do you think? Like, who would rob a Christian bookstore? The same guy, maybe, that a few weeks before had thrown a brick through the front window and stolen, like, a dozen Jesus statues. So don't put it past people to steal from a Christian bookstore. So anyway, so he leaves. So the store closed at about 9 o'clock that night. So I'm like, Lance is in the back and like just doing his thing. I'm at the front behind the cash register doing nothing, like just standing there, earning my $6 an hour, and this, you know, totally uneventful until. About 8:30, this guy kind of walks in. There's nobody else in the store. It's like, it's me at the front doing nothing. It's a big store, pretty big store. I mean, like, it's one of the bigger Family Christian bookstores. So, you know, like, Lance is in the back. I'm up front doing nothing. Guy kind of walks in with, like, the limp, you know? I mean, like the, you know, like the up to no good limp, right? You can't possibly be doing anything productive if you limp. So he kind of like, I'm standing there like playing it cool. I'm not thinking, I'm not, you know, I'm still not worried because I'm 17, like stuff doesn't scare me. And so he walks up to the counter, and now the counter, right, like I'm trapped. Let's keep that in mind. There's a row of cash registers that just kind of hooks back to the front of the store. And like the closest exit would require me throwing myself over a counter. I'm trapped. So he walks up and he says, hey man. He says, do you work alone? And I'm like, at first I was like, I don't really know what you just said. but he's like, he can see that like, I'm not understanding him. He says, Do you work alone? At this point, like, I heard what he just said. And he just asked me if I work alone. Why does he want to know if I work alone? Like, at this point, like, I instead of, like, feeling like 17, I feel like I'm 7, and I'm really scared, and, like, this guy's probably about to murder me. Like, why does he want to know if I work alone? Like, I'm thinking to myself, no, I don't work alone. Lance is in the back. But he's like, what am I supposed to do? I mean, like, I can't give it away that Lance is in the back of the store because that's like perfect chance. He'll just kill me right there. Like, what am I have to have a plan here. Like, I'm about to die. Lance is in the back organizing Stephen Curtis Chapman CDs. I'm about to lose my life for a Christian bookstore. Like, this is not going to end well. Like, what am I supposed to say to this guy? Like, it's been, I don't know, I feel like it's been about 10 minutes of me just standing there, like, with this, like. He can tell, like, something's up. This guy's not getting it. And he says it again. He says, man, do you work alone? Like, holy crap. Like, he really wants to just kill me right now. Like, do I just give him the money? Like, I don't know what to do. And so at this point I say, what? And what else am I supposed to say? He said, do you work alone? And so, like, I just immediately said, no, I do not work alone. Lance is in the back. And so at this point, he's like, hold up. He could tell, like, I'm not getting what he's saying. And he clearly thinks I'm weird because he definitely did not ask me if I worked alone. And so he repeats himself. He said, no, man, do you wear cologne? I have a trunk full of cologne, and I just want to know if you wear cologne. I would like to sell you some cologne. And so I'm like, I'm tingling all over. Like, woo! Yes! He does not want to kill me. He just wants to know if I wear cologne. Like, I probably peed my pants a little. Like, it's not a good situation. But I felt good because I was not going to die. And so I looked at him and said, no, I do not wear cologne, and we are closed. Thank you.
Josh Pickford is a maker and the founder of Bear Metrics. You can learn more about him at his website, joshpickford.com.
We're always saying that everyone has great stories to tell, but I think that, frankly, a lot of people just don't believe us. However, Josh's story proves our point. His story is so simple, really just a retelling of a misunderstanding, yet It is a blast to listen to.
Yeah, that's why finding stories is only just part of what we do. There are stories that are going to be great just simply because of how amazing they are. However, there are many other stories that become great in the telling. So we spend just as much time, more even, working with the storytellers to make sure their story is told as good as it can be told.
But every now and then, we come across a story that's both great and told well. That was the case with this next story. We heard it, and it needed very little work at all. It comes from an event we did in partnership with the Birmingham Museum of Art and our friends at The Moth, where the theme was storytelling and Southern identity. Here's storyteller Glenny Brock.
I worked in newspapers for a long time, until one day I just quit. I walked out of a meeting that I will describe here as emotionally rich. I walked out of it, and I walked through downtown Birmingham to a theater where I had been volunteering for a long time, and I walked into the executive director's office, and I said to him, I am going to need some place to go every day, and it cannot be that newspaper office ever again. So for the last couple of years, I've introduced myself a lot as a recovering journalist. This gets a lot of laughs from journalists and drunks and anybody who is recovering from anything. But I use the line because it's funny and because it really provides me cover. And what I mean by that is whenever I say it, it's like saying, I'm not who you think I am because I'm still who I used to be. And who I used to be was somebody who spent a lot of time in this museum. I wrote a lot about music and art in the post-civil rights movement South. That's what it said on my CV. I wrote about the Klansmen convicted of bombing the 16th Street Baptist Church. I wrote about the quilts of G's Bend. I wrote about the beheaded black baby dolls I saw in Joe Minter's African Village in America. I wrote about all kinds of things. What I did not write about was the book Black Like Me. And what I especially did not write about was that time in eighth grade when I did a book report on it in blackface. What did she just say? What? Blackface was what I said, ladies and gentlemen. It was 1991 or 92. Otherwise, there would be photographic evidence. Nobody had an iPhone. So the only thing I can do up here is portray that girl white, like me, in words. So imagine Birmingham, Alabama. Close your eyes and picture it. If you haven't spent a lot of time here, you probably don't see Red Mountain in your mind. You probably don't see that cool blue caraway star, and you don't see the unchecked kudzu that turns everything green. Probably, well, let's see, you might see a stained glass window with the face of Christ blown out. You might see four little kids turned into corpses in the basement of their own church. Maybe. You probably see like the same old two-tone we can't stop showing the world, right? White bowl, dog teeth, fire hose, white water venom coming out of it fast enough to knock a man down. Right. Black and white. That's my hometown. That's what the picture that we show to the world over and over and over again. Those four little girls, one was 11, three were 14, which is the same age I was in 1992, right? So this book report assignment comes down, and we have two choices. We can write a certain number of pages, or we can make a presentation. So I thought of myself as a prodigy poet at that age, but I was a terrible student, terrible. My mother had died when I was 8. I had three older brothers, and they were so much older than me, they were already out of the house. My dad had remarried in 1990, when I was 12. I had really mixed feelings about my stepmother, but I took great comfort in the comforts of her house. She lived in this posh neighborhood that my dad and I had moved into, and her house was beautiful. I had my first bagel there. I had my first sips of wine. Her first husband had been a doctor, and when they got divorced, he had left behind some stuff, including all these real fly suits from the 70s, all these corduroy suits, and dozens of vinyls, and about six or eight shelves of classics and paperbacks, one of which was Black Like Me. Do you know the plot of Black Like Me? I'll tell you. It's nonfiction. In 1959, the Texas journalist John Howard Griffin goes to a dermatologist with a, quote, astonishing request, end quote. He decides he wants to take medication to darken his skin so he can travel through the Deep South and get answers to two questions. One, if a white man becomes a Negro in the Deep South, what adjustments does he have to make? Two, what would it be like to experience discrimination based on the color of your skin, something over which one has no control? So the dermatologist agrees, and Griffin does it. He takes medication, and he tans, and he shaves his head, and he shaves all the hair off his arms, and he even uses some kind of stain, and he goes on the road. He goes to Atlanta, to New Orleans. He said Hattiesburg was hell. He goes to Mississippi. He goes all over the place, and everywhere he is patronized and threatened, and most of all ignored. More than anything else, he's ignored. And for a little while, he is something in the South rarer than a unicorn, which is a black man whose melanin is mostly on a timer, right? A black man who has enjoyed white privilege his entire life until he decides really briefly to give it up. So this story blew my mind, right? And I thought, when this book report assignment came, I thought, I am going to blow some people's minds right now. But think of all the passing I had to do in order to really do it right, in order to really blow somebody's mind. I had to pass as somebody from a different decade, and I had to pass as a man, and I had to pass as black, and I had to do it all from the girls' bathroom in my middle school. Right? So what I did is I got some of my stepmother's first husband's clothes from the closet. I got these bell-bottom trousers, and I got a corduroy vest, and I got a necktie, and I got some size 10 men's shoes, and I went to school with all of it in my little bag. And I knew that achieving color was going to be complicated, but I had a plan for that too. I took, by which I mean stole, borrowed, whatever, all of my stepmother's good makeup. I don't mean foundation, because that was too pale, useless. I got several different packets of blush, the darker the better, and especially I got this big fan-shaped plastic palette that had 41 different shades of eyeshadow. Right? And then I got a number two pencil, and I pulled the eraser out, and I chewed down the end, so I had fashioned it into a tiny shovel, and I decided I could use this to scoop out all of the eyeshadow. Right? So I'm scooping it out, and I've got it in little drifts in my hand, and I figured out that the way to become black was just to use all the colors. Yes. So I get some brown and some red and some gray, and I do my face first, and then I get my face the way that I really want it, and then I do the backs of my hands, and I look myself, I'm in the girls' bathroom, WJ Christian Middle School, and I look in the mirror. I can't quit looking in this mirror. I think about something that John Howard Griffin had said, you know, about his experience when he had first changed. He said, the transformation was total and shocking. I had expected to see myself disguised, but this was something else. So there I am in front of the mirror, and I'm thinking, this transformation is total and shocking. In my case, it was a little uneven, because although it was 1992 blackface, I still had 80s bangs going that were really great. So, you know, I've got it. I am ready. And I look in the mirror one more time and I say, I am John Howard Griffin, and I wrote a book called Black Like Me. So I walk out of the bathroom, and then things get a little fuzzy just for a few minutes. It's like I kind of have this out-of-body experience, so I barely remember walking out of the bathroom, and I barely remember walking past the sixth grade lockers, and I barely remember walking into the classroom, but I do remember that my classmates gasped. They all went, and, you know, some of them could not stop laughing. And my teacher, Miss Dario, she had this halo of red hair, and she was just looking at me, not quite smiling, like, like kind of shaking her head, and just looking at me. And I stood in front of that classroom, and I said, I am not who you think I am. I am John Howard Griffin, and I wrote a book called Black Like Me. And nobody ever beat me, but I was threatened and I feared for my life in a way that no white man can ever understand. And they're all just looking. They're all just looking. And I went on for many minutes. I raved for several minutes about racial injustice, and some of my classmates fell silent, and all of them just stared, and a few of them maybe cried, but I'm pretty sure it was from laughing. So once I am done, I have my say, and I want to keep quoting John Howard Griffin because I'm really into it. And at some point, I remember screaming. I was like, I have tampered with the nature of existence, and in doing so, lost the sense of myself. This is what devastated me. They're all like, okay. That's what I said. I said, this is what devastated me. But that's not really what devastated me. I didn't say what devastated me. I couldn't say it. I didn't say it. I didn't really know it until after the bell rang. And it's a few minutes later, and I'm alone in the bathroom. And I've got a white girl's eyes looking at me out of a black man's face. And I'm thinking, who do you think you are? I had passed, all right. I got an A on that report. I got a standing ovation. But the one thing that I didn't tell my teacher or my friends was that I didn't know how Black Like Me ended, because I'd never finished the book. Thank you.
Glenny Brock is a writer and editor and currently works as volunteer coordinator for Birmingham Landmarks. You can find her on Twitter at Glenny Brock.
I love the passion that Glenny possessed as a little girl. There's the serious question of how much John Howard Griffin could identify with the black experience in America, but there's also no doubt that Glenny couldn't identify with him just by reading his book. Yet, something really connected with her, a desire to see injustices made right that would drive her to do something so ill-conceived to try to make a point.
Then you add in the fact that she never actually finished Black Like Me, and it reminds you that right along with the passion also the naivete and irresponsibility we all possessed as kids. But that's also what makes her story so charming. Blackface normally shouldn't fly, but it was born out of such innocence, and it's like we almost forgive it. Our next story actually directly involves a daughter's innocence as she helps her dad save face. That's coming up in just a moment on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories. Thanks for joining us for ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's true stories told by the people who live them and recorded in front of a live audience. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley.
And I'm ARC Stories director Taylor Robinson. Some of my favorite moments are when a storyteller will stand up in front of an audience and be completely vulnerable, no matter how unflattering it may make them look. In fact, I actually believe it ends up causing the listeners of the story to like them even more. That was absolutely the case with this next story, and it was recorded at an event we hosted at Urban Standard where the theme was My Old Man, Stories About Fathers, and it actually comes from this guy sitting right here with me. Here's storyteller Chris Kinsley.
In my opinion, there is perhaps nothing better in life than being able to share the things you love with people you love. And that is what I was most looking forward to about becoming a father, was being able to share with my offspring the things that I love about life, that I love to do, that I'm interested in, and hoping that maybe they would share some of those same interests with me. Now, chief among these things I was looking forward to sharing with my children is my love for movies. That's the one thing I want to do all the time. If I have any free time, I want to go to the movies. So I was super excited when my wife and I finally had a little girl that is named Story to share with her this love of movies. And thankfully, Story shares that same love that I do. Now, because she is a little girl in our culture, you can probably guess like what her favorite kind of movies are. And they are princess movies, mostly Disney princess movies. And going into having a little girl, I was definitely not excited about the Disney princesses whatsoever. And the reason why is because I feel like those movies like teach little girls something that's not super helpful. You know, they teach them that they're waiting to be rescued, that they need a prince. You know, there's lots of beauty image issues and stuff wrapped up into that. Now, you know, I want to combat that a little bit as much as possible. But when I had a child of my own and she got into princess movies, I realized I had overlooked a huge positive. And that is that for her, when she thinks about that prince, she doesn't think about any little boy that's like in her class at daycare or in her Sunday school at church. She thinks, that's me.
I'm the prince. Like, I am the undefeatable hero that can ride in at any moment. And not just in a story, like literally in life. If she skins her knee, if someone is mean to her, she knows that she can call out to dad, and dad's going to come running. And dad's going to deal with it. Dad's going to come for her. Like, dad will come to the rescue. He will be the hero. And I love that feeling. I love that she sees me that way. So combining all this in one thing, I knew that I was going to have huge success when I found out that Disney was releasing a new princess movie called Frozen. And I didn't know a lot about it going into it. I just knew it was an animated princess feature, and therefore, if I took her to see it, it would be a win. And so we did. I came home one day, story, I want to take you to the movies tonight. There's a new movie. And we don't watch a lot of like live TV at home. You know, we do Netflix, Amazon Prime, that kind of thing. But so she hadn't seen trailers or commercials or anything. Like, she's going in blind, so I know it's going to blow her mind. It's going to be great. And I will once again come out the hero in a lot of different ways. And so we go, and going to the movies for us is an experience. Like, we have rituals and things that are surround it, and it's not just sitting in a theater. That we're going to go to the arcade, we're going to play the claw game, we're really good at it. I mean, we might drop $20 on it, but chances are we're going to come out, you know, 1 in 20, we're going to hit one of those toys. So we're going to have a very cheaply made overpriced toy that's going to go with us. We go into the photo booth, and we take the series of the four photos in the photo booth. We kind of do the same pictures every time, and it spits out two strips. So one strip gets hung on her door at home. The other strip goes with me to my office and gets hung there so we can look at them and remember, you know, the night. And we go and we get the snacks. Like, Story gets a little kids, you know, value meal. She's got the popcorn and her little kid drink and some fruit snacks. And I'm ordering, you know, my bag of popcorn and, you know, my hot tamales and my large Coke. And do we want to upgrade both our drinks to the collectible? Well, yes, of course. So, you know, Story's got a character from Monsters University on the top of it with a straw, you know, and he's holding the straw in his hand kind of thing. And I get like the collectible Hunger Games bucket of Coke with Katniss Everdeen on the outside. And we load it up, and I have to explain the story. Now, be careful as we're walking. We got to walk up steps. You got to really hold it, you know, because if we spill it, like, we've ruined the evening. There's tears galore, and there will be no recovery. So we've got to make sure this gets, and I'm stuffing the pocket, get everything. We get in there, we get in the movies, and we watch Frozen, and it's everything I expected to be. A, it's a pretty good movie. B, it like actually breaks some of those princess things I was real worried about, like the love that's at the center of the story is between the sisters, spoiler alert. And so that's very helpful, not just about the dudes in the film. And, you know, I'm watching the movie, but I'm also looking over, and I watch her, and when the abominable snowman comes out, she, you know, kind of whimpers a little bit and curls up beside me, and that's awesome, put my arm around, you know. We're getting comfort and everything like that, and when it's exciting, she's into it, she's laughing at the snowman, she's real, like, she's picking up on the songs as they're sung. It's just huge, wonderful night. Movie ends, and she is just all smiles. We get out into the lobby, and she's asking me about the music, so I immediately pull out my phone, I go to iTunes, I download the soundtrack right there in the lobby of the movie theater, because we're gonna listen to it on the way home. We're gonna rock out, and everything's going to be wonderful. Except that taking the time to download the album maybe not was the best decision on my part. And the reason why is because the collectible bucket of Coke featuring Katniss Everdeen on the outside had like caught up with me. I really had to pee really bad. And as much as I, like, one of my favorite things in the world being to take my daughter to the movies, probably the absolute thing I look forward to the least in the world is having to take my daughter to a public men's restroom. Because we are filthy. There's no surface in a public men's restroom that is appropriate to be touched. Like, there is stuff all over everything. And little kids can't help but touch everything. They can't read, you know, they have to push to hop up on, their feet don't touch the ground, you know, and it's falling, and, you know, and they're just gonna go out and, like, stick it in their mouth, you know, stick their hands in their mouth. And it's just awful. Like, she's about like 4.5 going on 5. Like, she's become more aware of her surroundings, and there's things in a public men's restroom that are out and about that you don't want her to be aware of yet. it's not good. You know, it's just not a good situation. I literally avoid doing it at all costs. And so this night, I avoided it. Like, had to go, but we're download the album. Let's get in the car. Let's go home. I'll just take care of things there. So we go, we get in my car. We're driving home. We're playing the soundtrack. It's going great. We're going through it. We're singing, "Do You Want to Build a Snowman?" We're dancing around in the car together. And that's really helpful because, like, I've got full-on pee dance going. Like, it is moving in the front seat. We're driving. You know, thankfully, I don't have to shift or work the clutch too much, so I can kind of squeeze things together a little bit and just keep it going because it is, like, building within. And I don't know if, like, sitting down is putting pressure on something, but the pressure is building, literally. And it gets to the point where I realize, we're not going to make it. I mean, we only have about like 10 minutes to drive from the theater to the house. We're not going to make it. And we live in the suburbs. And pulling over and relieving oneself in someone's front yard is frowned upon where I come from. But I think on the road that we go, on the way, there is kind of this like outpatient rehab facility that has a parking lot. I'm just gonna have, like, that's where we're gonna have to deal with things. And so we're going, we're listening to the soundtrack, we're singing along, and I tell Story, "Hey, Story, Daddy's gotta pull over and take care of something. You're just gonna stay in the car and keep listening to the music, right?" And she's like, "Yeah, okay, Dad, no problem." And so we're going, and I turn, I pull into the parking lot, and at that moment, my body decides to join Queen Elsa in singing her anthemic climactic song from the movie Frozen, and it joins her in saying, "Let it go, let it go, can't hold me back anymore," and it doesn't. It lets it go, and it is going and going and going. It's a scenario that I know none of you had experienced, but like, I've got to go in my pocket and rescue my cell phone type situation. And it's like, I can't even put on the brake to stop. We're just kind of rolling through the parking lot as it's going. I reach over, I just turn up the volume a little bit. Finally, I stop. And so I stop the car and sit for a moment and try to process what has just happened. There's no processing that. There's lots of shame and guilt and bad feelings happening. And we decide, there's nothing further to be done here in this parking lot. We will just continue on our way back to the house. Thankfully, I have rescued my phone, so I text my wife to let her know I'm going to need some assistance when we get home. I'll need you to come out and through the driveway to get Story, and I'm going to have to take care of some other things. Having to admit this to your wife is not an exciting situation. Had I been by myself, I would have come up with any number of other scenarios to cover, but we just had to admit we're going to try to keep it tight just between the two of us. Maybe we can avoid Story knowing. And I get home and pull into the driveway. My wife has obviously been waiting for us. She comes out with a somewhat compassionately concerned, severely disappointed look on her face. And she opens the door and she gets Story out. And Story questions her about why I'm not getting out of the car. And Elijah's trying to say, "Don't worry about it. Dad's just got to do something. Just don't worry." And Story says, "Is it because grown-ups sometimes have accidents too?" I guess there was a smell associated. But Liza, my wife, didn't quite hear Story, what exactly she said. So she said, what's that, baby? What'd you say?" And Story just looks at her, looks at me, and just says, "Never mind." Because, you know, as a dad, you want to protect that image of yourself for as long as you can. At some point, you're going to let your daughter down. You're going to let your children down. They're going to find out you're not the undefeatable hero. But you want to keep that facade up for as long as possible. And you don't want it to end in a way like that. But if you're as lucky as I am, then maybe you'll have a child like mine who will want it to last just a little bit longer too, and will kind of wipe away your mistakes with just a little, never mind. Thank you.
In addition to hosting this radio show with me, Chris is also a producer, story coach, and the host of the ARC Stories podcast. Where can they find out more about you, Chris?
You can follow me on Twitter at Chris Kinsley.
When you sent me that story, I honestly couldn't believe you wanted to tell it.
You know, at first, I didn't want my wife to tell that story to anyone. Yeah. But I finally figured, you know, what does it matter? Yeah, it might be embarrassing for me, but most importantly, I love what it says about my daughter. She still lets me be her hero, though I'm certainly not one.
Well, if you have a story that you would like to tell at one of our events, go to our website, arcstories.com, and submit the story through our story portal. You can also find out how you can become part of the audience at one of our events and listen to other people pour their hearts out just like Chris and our other storytellers.
Thanks for listening to ARC Stories Radio. This program is produced by ARC Stories in partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crowell, Program Director at WBHM, as well as Audrey Atkins, Marketing Manager, Will Dahlberg, Membership Manager, and Rachel Lindley, News Director. The General Manager for WBHM is Scott Hanley. Recording and mastering was by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design, and Territory 3 provides our website. Special thanks to Aaron Moon and Nate Dreger for making this episode possible. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on our website, arcstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, you can stay up to date with all of our events, and even submit your own story. After all, we are always asking, what's your story?